Chapter 12.
All right, comrades, I admit it, Butcher said. I slept with the proprietress. What else could I do? I had to do something. What's the use otherwise of having a furlough? After all, I don't want to go back to the front like a calf.
He was sitting beside Feltman's bed, in one hand his mess kit cover full of coffee, his feet in a pail of cold water. He had raised blisters on them after wrecking the bicycle.
And you?
He asked Graber.
What did you do today? Were you out this morning?
No.
No?
He was in the sack, Feltman said, till noon. No row could raise him. It's the first time he's shown some sense.
Butcher withdrew his feet from the water and examined the soles. They were covered with large white blisters.
Just look at that! I'm a big, powerful fellow, but I have feet as sensitive as an infant's. It's been that way all my life. They won't harden up. I've tried everything, and I've got to start off again on these.
Why? You can take it easy now, Feltman said. You've got the proprietress.
Oh, the proprietress, man. That hasn't anything to do with it. Besides, it was a big disappointment.
The first time is always a disappointment after you come back from the front. Everyone knows that.
That's not what I mean. It went off all right, but she was not the right one.
You can't expect everything all at once. The woman has to adjust herself.
You still don't understand me. She was very good, but our souls didn't meet. Just listen. There we are in bed. The affair is in progress, and all at once I forget myself in the heat of the engagement and call her Alma. But her name is Louisa. Alma is my wife's name, you see.
I see.
It was a catastrophe, comrade. It serves you right,
one of the card players at the table said suddenly and sharply to Butcher.
That's the proper punishment for adultery, you pig. I hope she threw you right out with drums and trumpets.
Adultery?
Butcher let go of his feet.
Who's talking about adultery?
You! The whole time! Or are you an idiot as well?
The card player was a little egg-headed man. He stared at Butcher with hatred. Butcher was highly indignant.
Did anyone ever hear such drivel?
He asked, looking around.
The only one who has said anything about adultery is you. It would be adultery, you fool, if my wife had been here and then I had slept with somebody else. But she isn't here. That's exactly the whole trouble. How can it be adultery? After all, if she were here, I wouldn't sleep with the proprietress.
Don't pay any attention to Egghead, Feltman said. He's just envious. What did she do then, after you called her Louisa?
Louisa? Not Louisa. Louisa is her right name. I called her Alma.
All right, Alma. And then?
And then? You wouldn't think it possible, comrade. Instead of laughing or raising a row, she began to howl. Tears like a crocodile. Imagine that. Big women oughtn't to cry.
Reuter coughed, closed his book, and looked at Butcher with interest.
Why not?
It isn't becoming to them. Doesn't go well with their bulk. Big women ought to laugh. Would your Alma have laughed if you had called her Louisa?
The egg-headed card player asked poisonously.
If my Alma had been there,
Butcher announced calmly and with immense authority, first of all, I'd have got the nearest beer bottle in my mug. After that, everything that wasn't bolted down. And finally, when I came to again, she would have taken care of me so that only my shoes were left. That's the way it would have been with my Alma, you camel! Egghead was silent for a while. The picture seemed to have overwhelmed him.
And you betrayed a woman like that?
He finally asked hoarsely.
But man, I didn't betray her at all! If she were here, I wouldn't so much as look at the proprietress. Something like that isn't betrayal. It's simple self-preservation.
Reuter turned to Graber.
And you? What did you achieve last night with your bottle of Armagnac?
Nothing.
Nothing?
Feltman asked.
And that's why you slept till noon like a dead man?
Yes. The devil only knows why I'm suddenly so tired. I could go right to sleep again. It's as if I hadn't shut my eyes for a week.
Then lie down and go to sleep again.
Wise advice, Reuters said. The advice of the master sleeper Feltman.
Feltman is a donkey, the egghead declared. He's sleeping away his whole eve. Then it will be exactly as though he hadn't had one at all. He could just as well have gone to sleep at the front and only dreamed his leave.
That's what you think, brother. Just the opposite is true. I sleep here, and when I am dreaming, I dream that I'm at the front.
And where are you actually? Reuter asked.
What? Here, of course.
Are you sure? The egghead bleated.
That's what I mean, he said. It makes no difference where he is if he's always in the sack. The ox just doesn't know that.
It does make a difference if I wake up, you wiseacre, Feltman declared, suddenly irritated, and lay back.
Reuter turned back to Graber.
And you? What do you intend to do for the immortal soul today?
Tell me where to go if you want a good dinner.
Alone?
No.
Then go to Germania. It's the only place. The only trouble is that they may not let you in. Not in your frontline outfit. It's a hotel for officers. The restaurant, too. However, the waiter may respect your hardware.
Graber looked down at himself. His uniform was patched and very shabby.
Couldn't you lend me your tunic?
Glad to. You're only 30 pounds lighter than I am. They wouldn't let you get past the door. But I can borrow a corporal's dress uniform in your size. Trousers, too. If you put your coat on over it, no one here in the barracks will notice. By the way, why are you still a doughfoot? You should have been a lieutenant long ago.
I was a corporal once, and I beat up a lieutenant and was broken for it. Luckily, they didn't send me to a disciplinary company. But after that, it was all up with promotion.
Good. Then you even have a moral right to the corporal's uniform. If you take your lady to the Germania, the wine to order is Johannesberger Kochsberg 1937 from the cellars of G.H. von Mumm. It's a wine that can raise the dead.
Good. That's what I need.
It had grown foggy. Graber was standing on the bridge over the river. The water was full of refuse and crawled black and sluggish among the rafters and kitchenware. Opposite, the silhouette of the school rose darkly out of the white mist. He stared over at it for a while. Then he went on across the bridge and along a little alley that led to the schoolyard. The big iron gate, dripping with moisture, stood wide open. He went in. The schoolyard was empty. There was no one there. It was too late for classes. He walked across the yard to the edge of the river. The trunks of the chestnut trees stood in the fog as dark as though made of coal. Under them were the damp benches. Graber remembered sitting there often. None of the things he had dreamed of at that time had come true. He had gone from school to the war. For a time, he stared at the river. A broken bedstead had been swept ashore. On it, the white pillows lay like fat sponges. He shivered. Then he went back and stopped in front of the school building. He tried the front door. It was unlocked. He opened it and went in hesitantly. In the entrance hall, he stopped and looked around. There was an oppressive school smell, and he saw the half-darkened stairway and the dark-painted doors that led to the assembly hall and the classrooms. He felt nothing, not even contempt or irony. He thought of Velma. One must not go back, he had said. He had been right. Graber felt nothing but emptiness. All the experience he had gained since his school years contradicted what he had learned here. Nothing had remained. It was bankruptcy. He turned around and went out. At either side of the entrance, he saw memorial plaques for the dead. He remembered the one on the right. It was for those who had fallen in the First World War. It had always been decorated with spruce greens and oak leaves for party celebrations, and Schimmel, the principal, had made glowing orations in front of it about revenge, Greater Germany, and the retribution to come. Schimmel had had a fat, soft belly and always sweated a great deal. The plaque on the left was new. Graeber had never seen it. It was for those fallen in the present war. He read the names. There were many of them, but the plaque was large, and next to it, there was space for another one. Outside in the schoolyard, he met the beetle.
Are you looking for something?
The old man asked. No, I'm not looking for anything. Graeber walked on. Then an idea occurred to him. He went back. Do you know where Polman lives? He asked. Herr Polman, who used to teach here.
Herr Polman is no longer employed here.
I know that. Where does he live? The beetle glanced around. There's no one around to overhear us, Graeber said. Where does he live?
He used to live at Janplatz 6. I don't know whether he still lives there. Were you a pupil here?
Yes. Is Schimmel still here, the principal?
Of course, the beetle replied in astonishment. Of course he's still here. Why shouldn't he still be here?
Yes, Graeber said. Why not? He walked on. After a quarter of an hour, he realized that he no longer knew where he was. The fog had grown heavier, and he had lost his way among the ruins. They all looked alike, and the streets could no longer be told apart. It was a strange feeling, as though he had lost his way inside himself. It took him a while to find Hockenstrasse. The wind had suddenly sprung up, and the fog began to heave and roll like a noiseless, ghostly sea. He went to his parents' house. He found no message there and was about to go on when he heard a curious resonant note. It was like the sound of a harp. He looked around. The street was empty as far as he could see. The sound came again, higher now, plaintive and diminishing, as though an invisible buoy were ringing out its warning in the sea of fog. It was repeated, deeper, then higher, irregularly and yet at almost uniform intervals, and it seemed to come out of the air as though someone on the roof were playing a harp. Graeber listened. Then he tried to follow the notes, but he could not determine their direction. They seemed to be everywhere and to come from everywhere, strong and challenging, now singly and now like an arpeggio, an unresolved chord of inconsolable grief. The air raid warden, he thought. The madman. Who else? He went to the house where only the facade was standing and jerked open the door. A figure inside sprang up out of an easy chair. Graeber saw it was the green chair that had been standing in the ruins of his parents' house.
What's the matter?
The air raid warden asked sharply in alarm. Graeber saw he had nothing in his hand. The notes went on resounding.
What's that?
He asked.
Where does it come from?
The warden brought his damp face close to Graeber's.
Ah, the soldier, the defender of the fatherland. What is that? Don't you hear it? That is the requiem for those who are buried, the cry for help. Dig them out! Dig them out! Cease this murdering!
Nonsense. Graeber stared upward through the rising fog. He saw something like a dark cable swinging in the wind, and every time it swung back, he heard the mysterious gong-like note. All at once, he remembered the piano with the top missing that he had seen hanging high among the ruins. The cable was striking against the exposed wires.
It's the piano, he said. It's the piano! It's the piano!
The warden mimicked him.
What do you understand about it, you unconscionable murderer? It's the funeral bell, and the wind rings it. It is heaven calling for mercy, you rifle-shooting automaton, for that mercy which no longer exists on Earth. What do you know about death, you vandal? And what could you know? Those who cause it never know anything about it.
He stooped over.
The dead are everywhere, he whispered. They lie under the ruins. With their trodden faces and outstretched arms, they lie there, but they will arise and they will hunt all of you down.
Graeber stepped back into the street.
Hunt you down,
whispered the warden behind him.
They will accuse you, and judgment will be exacted for every single one of them.
Graeber could no longer see him. He only heard the hoarse voice issuing from the eddying wisps of fog.
For whatever ye have done unto the least of these, my brethren, that have ye done unto me, saith the Lord.
He walked on. Go to hell, he muttered. Go to hell and bury yourself under those ruins you perch on like a bird of death. Death, he thought bitterly. Death, death. I've had enough of death. Why did I come back? Wasn't it to feel that somewhere in this wilderness there is life, too? He rang. The door opened at once as though someone had been standing right behind it.
Oh, it's you,
said Frau Leeser, taken aback. Yes, me, Graeber replied. He had expected Elisabeth. Just then she came out of her room. This time Frau Leeser withdrew without a word.
Come in, Ernst, Elisabeth said. I'll be ready right away.
He followed her. Is that your brightest dress? He asked, looking at the black sweater and dark skirt she was wearing. Have you forgotten we're going out tonight?
Did you really mean it?
Of course. Just look at me. This is a dress uniform belonging to a corporal. A friend of mine borrowed it for me. I've become an imposter so that I can take you to the Hotel Germania, and it's still a question whether anyone lower than a lieutenant can get in. That depends on you. Haven't you another dress?
Yes, but...
Graeber saw Binding's vodka on the table. I know what you're thinking, he said. Forget it. And forget Frau Leeser and the neighbors. You're not hurting anyone. That's the one thing that counts. And you have to get out of here sometime, otherwise you'll go crazy. Here, have a drink of vodka. He filled a glass and handed it to her. She emptied it.
All right, she said. I won't take long. I was already half prepared, but I didn't know whether you'd remember. Only you've got to get out of the room while I change. I don't want to be denounced by Frau Leeser for prostitution.
She wouldn't get away with it in this case. With soldiers, that counts as patriotism. But I'll wait for you outside. On the street, not in the vestibule. He walked up and down on the street. The fog had grown thinner, but it still eddied between the walls of the houses like steam in a laundry. Suddenly a window clattered open above him. Elisabeth leaned out, bare-shouldered in a frame of light, holding two dresses in her hands. One was golden and the other nondescript and darker. They fluttered like flags in the wind.
Which?
She asked. He pointed to the golden one. She nodded and closed the window. Graeber looked around. The street was still empty and dark. No one noticed the violation of the blackout. He walked up and down again. But the night suddenly seemed to have become vaster and fuller. The weariness of the day, the strange mood of the evening, and his determination to turn away from the past had slowly transformed themselves into a mild excitement that now all at once turned into impatient expectation. Elisabeth came through the door. She came quickly, and she was slender and supple and seemed taller than before in the long golden dress, which glittered in the faint light. Her face, too, had changed. It was thinner, and her head seemed smaller, and it took Graeber a moment to realize that this was because she was wearing a low-necked dress. Did Frau Leeser see you? He asked.
Yes, she was speechless. She is convinced that I ought constantly to do penance in sackcloth and ashes. For a minute I had a bad conscience.
It's always the wrong people who have a bad conscience.
It's not just a bad conscience. It's fear as well. Do you think...
No, Graeber replied. I don't think anything. And tonight we're not going to do any more thinking either. We've thought enough for a while, and it's made us edgy enough, too. Now we're going to see for once whether we can't just have a good time. The Hotel Germania stood between two wrecked houses like a rich woman between needy relatives. The rubble had been neatly piled up on either side, and as a result, the two ruins no longer seemed wild and haunted by death. They had already been made orderly and almost respectable. The doorman examined Graeber's uniform with an appraising glance.
Where's the wine room?
Graeber asked sharply before he could say anything. To the rear at the right of the hall, sir. Please ask for Fritz, the head waiter. They walked along the corridor. A major and two captains passed them. Graeber saluted. They say it's crawling with generals here, he said. A couple of military commissions have their offices on the second floor. Elizabeth stopped.
Then aren't you being very reckless? Suppose someone noticed your uniform.
What would they notice? It's not hard to behave like a corporal. I used to be one myself. A lieutenant colonel, accompanied by a small, thin woman, strode by, spurs ringing. He looked straight over Graber's head.
What will happen to you if they find out?
Elizabeth asked. Nothing serious.
Could they shoot you?
Graber laughed. I don't believe they would do that, Elizabeth. They need us too much at the front.
What else might happen to you?
Nothing much. At most a couple of weeks of rest. That would be a couple of weeks of rest. Almost like a furlough. When you have to be back at the front in about 2 weeks, there's not much that can scare you. Headwaiter Fritz emerged from the passage at the right. Graber slipped a bill into his hand. Fritz allowed it to disappear and made no difficulties. The wine room, for dinner, of course, he said, and solemnly led the way. He seated them at a table hidden behind a pillar and departed with dignity. Graber glanced around. Just what I wanted. I need some time to accustom myself to this. And you? He looked at Elizabeth.
You certainly don't, he said in surprise. You look as though you came here every day.
A little old waiter who looked like a marabou appeared. He brought them the menu. Graber took it, placed a bill inside, and handed it back to the marabou.
We'd like to have something that's not on the menu. What have you?
The marabou looked at him expressionlessly.
We have nothing except what is on the menu.
All right, then for the time being, bring us a bottle of Johannesberger Kochsberg 1937 G.H. von Mumm. Not too cold.
The marabou's eyes lit up.
Very good, sir,
he said with sudden respect. Then he bent over.
We happen to have some Ostend sole on hand, absolutely fresh. With it, perhaps a Belgian salad and a few parsley potatoes?
Good. And what have you for hors d'oeuvres?
No caviar, of course, with the wine. The marabou became even more animated.
Of course not. But we still have a little Strasbourg goose liver, truffled,
Graber nodded.
And afterwards I recommend a piece of Dutch cheese. It will bring out the bloom of the wine completely.
Excellent. The marabou disappeared in excitement. He might at first have taken Graber for a soldier who had wandered in by chance. Now he saw in him a connoisseur who was by chance a soldier. Elizabeth had listened in amazement.
Ernst, she said. Where did you find out all that?
From my friend Reuter. This morning I didn't know any of it. He's such a great connoisseur that he has the gout. That, however, has rescued him from the front. Thus, as always, sin pays.
But the trick with the tip and the menu?
All from Reuter. He knows his way around here. How to behave like a man of the world. He taught me that, too. Elizabeth laughed suddenly. It was a warm, free, and tender laugh.
God knows this isn't how I remember you, she said.
Nor I you, the way you are now. He looked at her. He had never seen her like this before. She changed completely when she laughed. It was as though all the windows in a dark house had suddenly opened.
That's a very beautiful dress, he said, a little embarrassed. It's one of my mother's. I made it over last night.
Do you mean you can sew? You don't look as if you could.
I couldn't either until some time ago, but I have learned. Now I sew army overcoats 8 hours a day.
Really? Were you snapped up by the labor service?
Yes, I had to join. And I wanted to, too. I thought perhaps it would help my father.
Graber looked at her and shook his head.
It doesn't suit you.
Not any more than your first name. How did you happen to get that?
My mother picked it out. She came from southern Austria and looked Italian, and she hoped I would be a blonde with blue eyes, and I was to be called Elizabeth. Then she called me that anyway, in spite of her disappointment.
The marabou came with the wine. He held the bottle as though it were a jewel, and he poured carefully.
I have brought you very thin, plain crystal glasses, he said. It's the best way to see the color. Or would you prefer goblets?
No, thin, clear glasses. The marabou nodded and uncovered a silver platter. The rosy slices of black truffled goose liver lay surrounded by a circle of quivering aspic.
"Fresh from Alsace," he announced proudly.
Elizabeth laughed.
"What luxury."
"Luxury?" Graeber raised his glass.
"Luxury," he repeated. "That's it. We'll drink to that, Elizabeth.
For 2 long years, I've eaten out of a 10 mess kit and was never quite sure whether I could finish my meal. So this is not simply luxury. It is much more. It is peace and security and joy and festivity. It is everything that is lacking out there." He drank and felt the wine and looked at Elizabeth, and she was part of it. It was always the unexpected, he suddenly realized, the thing that transcended need, the unnecessary, apparently useless, that produced lightness and elation, and this was so because these qualities belonged to the other side of existence, to the brighter side, to play and superfluity and dreams. After his years close to death, the wine was now not just wine, the silver not just silver, and the music that stole into the room from somewhere not just music. They were all symbols of that other life, the life without death and destruction, the life for life's sake that had already become almost a myth and a hopeless dream. "Sometimes one completely forgets that one's alive," he said. "I found that out today." Elizabeth laughed.
"I've known that all the time, but I could never put it to any use."
The marabou approached.
"How is the wine, sir?"
"It must be good, otherwise I wouldn't suddenly be thinking of things I haven't thought of in a long time."
"That's the sun, sir. The sun that ripened it in the autumn. It shines out of it again. In the Rhineland, they call a wine like this a monstrance."
"A monstrance?"
"Yes, it is full-bodied and like gold, and it shines in all directions."
"So it does."
"You feel it with the first glass, don't you?
Filtered sunshine.
Even at the first sip. It doesn't go into the stomach, it goes straight behind the eyes and changes the world."
"You understand about wine, sir."
The marabou bent toward him confidentially.
"Over there at that table to the right, they have the same wine. There where the 2 troop leaders are sitting, those persons pour it down as though it were water.
They ought to be drinking Liebfraumilch."
"This seems to be a good day for imposters, Elizabeth," Graeber said. "How's the wine for you? A monstrance, too?" She leaned back and stretched her shoulders.
"I feel like someone who has escaped from prison, and like someone who will soon be locked up again for swindling."
He laughed.
"That's how we are, afraid of our feelings. And when we become aware of them, we immediately think we are swindlers."
The marabou brought the sole and the salad. Graeber watched him as he served. He felt completely relaxed and seemed to himself like someone who has ventured out on thin ice and to his amazement finds that it holds. He knew it was thin and perhaps would not hold for long, but it was holding now, and that was enough. "There's one good thing about having lain in the dirt so long," he said. "Everything is as new and exciting as though you were seeing it for the first time. Everything, even a glass and a white tablecloth." The marabou held up the bottle. He was now like a mother.
"In general, Moselle is served with fish," he explained. "But sole is different. It has an almost nutty flavor. With it, wine from the Rheingau is a revelation, don't you think?"
"Absolutely." The marabou nodded and disappeared.
"Ernst," Elizabeth said, "can we pay for all this, too? It's sure to be frightfully expensive."
"We can pay for it. I have 2 years' combat pay with me, and it doesn't need to last long." Graeber laughed. "Only for a short life, Elizabeth. 2 weeks. It will do all right for that." They were standing in front of the door to the house. The wind had dropped and it had grown foggy again.
"When do you have to go back?"
Elizabeth asked.
"In 2 weeks?"
"Just about."
"That's soon."
"It's soon, and at the same time, it's a long way off. That changes from moment to moment. Time in war is different from time in peace. I'm sure you know that, too. It's just as much the front here as out there."
"It isn't the same."
"Yes, it is. And this evening was my first real day of leave.
God bless the marabou and Reuter and your golden dress and the wine. And us,
Elizabeth said.
We could use it.
She stood in front of him.
The mist hung in her hair, and the pale light glittered on it. It glittered on her dress, and the mist made her face damp as a fruit. It seemed suddenly hard for Graber to leave all this, the web of tenderness, relaxation, quietude, and excitement that had woven itself so unexpectedly over the evening, and go back to the stink and the jokes of the barracks, into the desolation of waiting and brooding over the future. A sharp voice cut through the stillness.
Have you no eyes in your head, Corporal?
A little fat major with a bushy white mustache was standing in front of them. He must have come up on rubber soles. Graber saw at once that he was a superannuated warhorse from the reserves who had been got out of mothballs and was now pulling his rank. He would have liked to pick the old man up and give him a thorough shaking, but he could not risk it. He acted as an experienced soldier should. He said nothing and stood at attention. The old man let his flashlight wander over him. For some reason, Graber found this especially insulting.
Dress uniform, barked the old man. You must have an armchair job to be able to afford something like that. A home front warrior in a dress uniform. That certainly is something. Why aren't you at the front?
Graber made no reply. He had forgotten to take his service ribbons from his old tunic and put them on the borrowed one.
Necking and petting, that's all you're good for, eh?
Barked the major. Elizabeth moved suddenly. The circle of the flashlight hit her face. She looked at the old man and stepped out of the beam toward him. The major cleared his throat, threw an oblique glance at her, and went off.
I'd had just about enough of him, she said.
Graber shrugged his shoulders.
You can't do anything about these old goats. They wander around the streets so that people will have to salute them. That's their life. To think that nature has labored for a couple of million years to produce something like that in the end.
Elizabeth laughed.
Why aren't you at the front?
Graber grinned.
That's what I get for cheating with this dress uniform. Tomorrow I'll put on civilian clothes. I know where I can borrow some. I've had enough of saluting. Then we can sit in peace tomorrow in the Germania. Do you want to go there again?
Yes, Elizabeth. Those are the things you remember later out there, not the commonplace. I'll come and get you at 8 o'clock.
And now I'm going. Otherwise that old fool will come by again and ask to see my paybook. Good night.
He drew her to him, and she yielded. He felt her in his arms, and suddenly everything dissolved. He wanted her, and he wanted nothing but her, and he held her close and kissed her, and did not want to let her go, and let her go. He went once more to Hockenstrasse. In front of his parents' house, he stopped. The moon broke through the mist. He bent down. Then with a sudden jerk, he pulled the notice out from between the stones. Something had been written in thick lead pencil on one corner. He reached for his flashlight. Inquire at main post office, window 15, he read. Involuntarily, he glanced at his watch. It was much too late. The post office was not open at night, and he would not be able to find out anything until 8 next morning. But then, at last, he would know. He folded the notice and put it in his pocket so that he could show it at the post office. Then he walked through the dead-still city to the barracks, and it seemed to him that he had no weight and was walking in a vacuum from which he dared not emerge.